If I can step in,
No.
it's pretty clear. You know, she wears that kind of Indian jacket, that yellow jacket that she walks around in. And as John has pointed out, she's the only person in The Shining that we see smoking, basically. And of course, tobacco is symbolic of a Native American sacrament.
Of
So the
course,
idea
going
that
into the
Wendy,
underworld at that. It was a protectant going to the underworld, absolutely, yeah.
So the idea that she's she also wears her hair braided from side to side in a kind of an Indian style ponytail.
So you're saying there is
Yeah, I think the
no
distinction here
conflict.
is really between the first hey and the second hey of Tetragrammaton, whereas the Indian princess would have, or you know, who goes to Pocahontas, would be the second hey that the glorified Malkuth, whereas Shelley Duvall is more of a first hey, which is indicated in her name as being a shell or a clipo that is merely a husk of holiness. But on the other hand, she is also Dorothy, and she sort of transforms herself into the second hand through the course of the film. And so here it gets tricky.
I don't know. I think in terms of The Shining, if I'm making a Wizard of Oz connection, I'd say that Danny is Dorothy, honestly. But I could be wrong about that.
But
Danny...
Wendy has the red boots at one point.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah.
Good point. Yeah.
I don't know. They both kind of are.
I'm sorry, I'm having trouble hearing you. Do you say something about hands, right hands?
I didn't.
Were you saying the hay?
He's talking about the hay, the
hay of the Kabbalah.
Yeah, Kabbalah. The letter hay is the fifth letter of the Hebrew alphabet, and it's paired with the star. We talked about it earlier.
And then they said.
I was just gonna mention that Wendy switches hands during her night vision. She
does she really
switches from left, left to right.
Wait,
from a bat to a knife,
John.
But that's something else.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. The switching of the hands is important because, as I pointed out, the 2001 Space Odyssey was filmed next door to Patrick McGowan's The Prisoner. Well, there's an episode of The Prisoner where Patrick McGowan gets brainwashed. He's tortured and brainwashed to end up using his opposite hand. Now, if this film, sorry, this TV show only had 17 episodes, 17 the star, only had 17 episodes, was being filmed next door to Stanley Kubrick, he actually lent them some footage from 2001 A Space Odyssey. You gotta figure that he saw those episodes.
Well, and also, like, one, they both take place on in like isolated hotels.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and have that kind of like self-producing reality. And I'm sure that, you know, like a guy like Patrick McGoon is definitely hanging out.
Right. That's a conversation I'd like to overhear. Patrick McGoon and Stanley Kubrick having a conversation.
Yeah.
Dig the motherfucker up. Let's bury Stanley Kubrick in the pet cemetery.
Yeah. Another Indian burial.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. Now, what do you guys make of the fact that Stephen King is sort of resurrecting Danny Torrance? He's got a new book coming out, Dr. Sleep, I think it's called, which tells the story of Danny as the adult. You made the point that Danny is now the age that Jack was. Stephen King maybe is trying to reclaim some control over The Shining as a story concept, and he's revisiting it with I believe the book's gonna be called Dr. Sleep.
Apparently it also revolves around vampires, which Mark will tell you brings Eyes Wide Shut into play.
Well, Kubrick was obsessed with vampire films, and particularly the British Hammer films. And all the interesting thing about those films is they combine the concept of vampires with that usually of some type of satanic rite, essentially. So when you're watching Eyes Wide Shut, you will be best informed if you have several viewings of a Hammer vampire films from the late 50s and the early 60s. Going into the early 70s, really, there's quite a few really good ones. And Kubrick is imitating these movies. It almost becomes funny. And in a sense, you know... Eyes Wide Shut is a very funny movie when you know what Kubrick was getting at in terms of the vampire movie, because that's all it is. It is an actual vampire film. And, you know, that the so-called, it's there in that Tom Petty song where he talks about how the party just moves further west to then in Free Falling to Ventura Boulevard, you know, and that this is my theory about how the vampire structure operates in reality today, because the vampire cannot be visible in the sense that they just can't go out there creating other vampires or leaving corpses everywhere. So what they do is they stage these parties forever on the edge of night, and they just keep going westward, staying ahead of the sun. They don't actually ever have to sleep, and they're literally partying. They are the jet set, and that leads back into the, yeah, there you go, Will, you're right there with me. They are the jet set, essentially. So I want to make a quick comment. What was it now? Oh, I've forgotten. I'll leave it at that for now, but I something we were talking about The Shining a second ago.
Well, the whole idea of vampires, I mean, it's a concept that is just, our entire culture is drowning in it. And you would have thought that this monster would have been exhausted its stay here, but it just seems to be getting almost stronger. I wonder if Tim Burton's Abraham Lincoln, the vampire killer, is essentially that. It's a movie designed to hopefully crush the whole reliance on the vampire metaphor in our culture.
Well, the vampire metaphor
it's like exploiting is
reflecting certain Kabbalistic like realities that really apply to all of us. And in that scene in Ziegler's party with Sandor, like, he's the devil, and then Alice represents Bill's soul, and so this guy is just feeding on Alice's soul while she's drunk, and she is like basically pouring all of her life into the shadow doppelganger figure, which goes back to the whole sexual gnosis sort of underlying Kubrick's films that nobody wants to talk about.
No one wants to talk about?
The sexual gnosis underlying Kubrick's films.
I thought we were talking about that. I thought we talked a lot of.
No, but in general,
we're dividing it from ourselves. We're saying, oh, look, these guys over here are sexual predators, but we don't see that this is applying to all of us. We're all Jack Torrance.
Exactly.
In a certain sense.
No, but that was my point earlier when I said, like, to me, The Shining is, you know, all these things he's showing how dark it is a warning, is a call to action to be. You know, to not be this fucked up.
You know, I'll disagree with you on that again.
I know that's cool. That's cool. I'm happy that we can
because I want to delineate something, because Jason makes the point that what Kubrick is telling us is that we're all a part of this devil's masquerade. We're all vampires of a type. But
right.
But no, and I agree with that, except for one problem. The thing of it is that not all of us know it. Not all of us act on it in a conscious sense. Am I going weird on you guys? Can you still hear me? Okay.
A little bit.
All right. Well, if I do go out, just cut me out. But we're not inherently conscious, and we're kept in a kind of a sleep, basically, in regards to our own vampire nature. And there appears to, and what Kubrick is saying in his films is that there is a class of vampires that are not in this sleep, that are awake to the fact that they're vampires, and that they
live, we sleep.
Yeah. No, I think that Kubrick is also doing this in a literal way as well, because he's using this guy as a stand-in for the dark tradition, which is, of course, based around the consumption of period blood and all of that in a ritual fashion, which represents sort of the dark tradition that he is opposing his own gnosis too in this film. So there is definitely an externalization of this that does exist within the magical community, which I think is what he's referring to.
And you must consider that, I mean, when I look at the vampire as the vampires as a mythology, you see that the vampire actually needed, in for the Bram Stoker version, the vampire needed to have its soil. So as John pointed out, the sort of that connection to the homeland, the soil, So he actually needed the soil from his homeland where he got his energy. So there's this nationalistic overtone. But I mean, ultimately, all that aside, when I really boil down the vampire myth, I see it as you had to let them in. There was this sort of like, the vampire couldn't hurt you unless you let them in. And, you let them into your home, or you let them into your soul. Basically, is this idea that there's temptation all around us. There's predators and temptation for us to be shit, for us to have that vampiric, parasitic nature. But if we don't let it in, this is a warning against letting that kind of mentality inside of us. That's ultimately, I really feel like that's the message of the vampire, is they were quote unquote normal, they were people, and then they let the darkness in. They're here, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, the idea that people just brought a television into their living rooms without really even grasping any of the complexity of the technology that they were exposing their family to. You know, now that we have a few decades to look back on it, I mean, it's astounding that you would even just so casually flip it on and allow 3-channel programming to just fill a dominant part of your life. I mean, the effects of television were well known by the Germans. I mean, I think in the German Olympics of 38, was it? They had televisions wheeled into villages throughout Germany so that they could show them the Olympics. I mean, this is incredible. I mean, you're talking about the nation that epitomizes fascism and propaganda and how powerful and how quickly you can unite a mass of people. And the technologies that they were developing and that they were foisting upon their people, you have television right there in the center. So you flash forward to now you have the internet. Well, the internet is in our pockets. You know, this is something that we carry with us for almost every waking minute of our lives. It's that whole vine on the tree imagery, I'm thinking.
I'd like everyone to, if just throw this out, if anybody gets a chance to read a short story by Kurt Vonnegut from Welcome to the Monkey House, it's called The UFO Question. And it's this idea that they basically make this euphoric box that everyone puts into their homes and just puts them into a trance. And anybody who's walking by the box just gets stuck into this trance. And I just was looking to see if I could find it online to send you guys. I found it here. And what do I see? It's like these lines, electronic opium den. It's what the public wants. This is like Louis Pasteur refusing to pasteurize milk. So we get the milk connection again. I mean, there's just, but I really think this is an ultimate question that people did question what would happen with this technology. Just as we have people questioning the internet and iPhones and every way that we're no longer viewing reality through our eyes, but through some sort of technical lens or technological lens. So it's definitely a good question.
I wanted to go back, Alan, to what you were saying there about the television. I think it was you, Alan. Might have been Bill. About TV being a... disseminated out of Germany. And the idea of it all tying into to Kubrick and his fascination with Germany, and particularly with Nazi culture, is interesting to me. The word German, and this fits in with this whole earlier concept we were talking about the star and how it was interposed by Crowley, and how this image it really is there in Kubrick. Germany, the word German actually means seed, right? As into germinate, right? So, and this idea of propaganda and the concept of propaganda really fulminating out of the area around Germany is very interesting to me. This idea of the media structure, it's something we gaze into and that gazes back into us, is and it comes into with this idea of looking into a mirror and also in changing hands, right? Because in the tarot, in Crowley's tarot, the Trump person, and this is what the changing, I wanted to say this back when we were talking about the changing of the hands, and it fits in nicely with this idea of this alter image this that we peer into. Because the Crowley tarot card shows the star, you know, pouring something, some sort of essence, and in this case it would be hay or seed or germ, from one hand into the other. And this idea of propaganda working in this exact same way is interesting, because right at the same time that the 2001 came out, there was this film, hardly anyone has ever seen it, it's called Journey to the Far Side of the Sun, and I put a link for it up there. It was called Doppelganger everywhere else, but in the United States it was called Journey to the Far Side of the Sun. And it's a film that has a lot in common with 2001, coming out right around the same time that it did. And in it, astronauts travel to an identical planet on the opposite side of the sun that cannot ever be seen. They only find out about it because of radio imagery from satellites and stuff like that. So they find this planet on the other side of the sun. And when astronauts go there, it turns out to be exactly the same as the Earth, only a reversed image. So everything is changed hands, basically. And of course, there's backwards writing and all of that
through
other
the
stuff
glass.
That Crowley talks about. What's that?
Through the looking glass. The looking glass world.
Yes. And the final image of the film is of a man in a wheelchair sitting in front of a mirror, and the mirror shatters, basically. So to me, the way that all this plays into media and, like, it's exactly what you said it is. It's a form of hypnosis that we all appear to be under, right? And relating that back into the concept that Jason was saying about or expressing that we're all vampires in a certain way, like, I guess the question that I'm trying to, that I struggle with is, is it always that way? And does it always have to be that way? And exactly where and when does this influence come in? Because if it doesn't have to be this vampire world, then there's at least an implication that there was some existing state prior to the sort of Soylent Green cannibalistic reality that we live in. So at what point, and what is the orientation of the force that brought this kind of vampire scenario into our reality? And for me, that emanates out of Saturn.
Has anyone seen, there's a new series of books that are like bestsellers called 50 Shades of Grey. It's basically about S&M bondage. And it's...
Yeah, it's big.
It's a huge
right
success.
Now.
But basically, when I first saw the cover, I assumed it was another book in the Twilight series, because the book covers look exactly like the design of the Twilight books. So I actually thought it was a Twilight book. So you go from promoting vampirism to promoting beating your spouse. If you love them, you're going to beat the fuck out of them, right? I mean, to me, this is ultimately the same idea that's being promoted. So I agree with you. There's some dark shit being promoted. It's, you know, the question of morality of who's putting out as a warning and who's putting it out to glorify it is ultimately it's a very gray area, I think.
It's the same way that, like, anti-drug propaganda films like from the 60s and 70s are basically how-to manuals on how to manufacture and distribute narcotics.
The doorway, it works both ways.
Well, it almost, I mean, really,
just like, you know, I also noticed that the service entrance, service doorways in the Overlook are also like the doors move on hinges that move both ways.
Right, yeah. Very interesting.
I actually don't take this view, you know, the overarching view of The Shining as incestuous child molestation. I think there's elements of it there, but
that was my issue here.
Well, let me just say what I'm going to say, and I'd like to hear.
It's not literally about child molestation.
Yeah, I just wanted to make the joke of in through the outdoor and Danny's red bum. Or, you know, his sort of swollen ass. But Jason, I think you and I are probably in agreement that the elements that we're seeing in of that is again not really the message, if there's a right or wrong way to read it, I mean, again, these are all open to interpretation, but please go ahead and say what you're going to say.
I think I said most of what I was going to say. What would you like to talk about?
Well, okay, I'll just jump in on the molestation thing. If we're going to take the awareness that the Red Book by Young is so prominent in Ullman's office, correct? Then we have to give the same credence to the Playgirl magazine and the fact that the Playgirl magazine is being read by Jack, and that one of the themes on the Playgirl magazine is incest. So if we're going to talk about Kubrick's knowledge of Jung and how he's using Jung's psychology as architecture in The Overlook, well, then we have to look at what the fuck does this Playgirl magazine
Jack mean? Jack sings both ways.
If we notice it through a fine-tooth comb on an HD or Blu-ray DVD that we slow down and freeze, that's one thing. But why does Ullman and Bill Watson, they don't think twice or blink twice when they come upon Jack casually reading a Playgirl magazine in the lobby of the Overlook Hotel? It would seem to me that casual of a artifact in a very in a sort of scene that we take to be very representative of the world that they're in, that a Playgirl magazine wouldn't cause any kind of reaction, just shows you how blind people were to the fact that certain people around them are not only raging alcoholics, but they might be rapists and they might be pedophiles. That the pedophile among you reading Playgirl magazine in the lobby would not alert you to their identity.
Wait. Presumably the hotel is aware that they have this magazine in their lobby. Do we think Jack brought it with him, or this was
No. I agree. I'm with Alan on this.
Yeah. So it's like.
Well, no. I'm saying this. Let's say you sit down. You got 10 minutes to kill before Ullman and Watson are going to come by and talk to you, right? There's a Sports Illustrated, there's a Time magazine, and there's a Playgirl. They walk up on you, and you've chosen the Playgirl, and maybe you're actually reading the article on incest. Maybe Bill Watson's got some keen Hawkeye vision, and as they leave that little scene, he turns to Ullman, is like, what the fuck's with the guy looking after the hotel? He's reading an article about incest in Playgirl. That little thread of reality, although is invisible to us, we can imagine it as being an actuality in the sort of
reality that we. The thing is that Bill Watson, Stuart Ullman, and then all of the magazines at the hotel are props of the hotel, right? So you can't they wouldn't expect him to be reading anything else.
Precisely.
As a matter of fact.
I'm saying you can stack realities upon realities, but at least be able to visualize and notice all of these realities. There is a thread in American life in the 70s and 80s that exploded onto the television in the form of talk shows. The awareness of rape and incest became a national fire that blazed across the screens of televisions in all of these living rooms, because there were people who it was happening to who didn't know that it was happening to them. They didn't know that this was something that had very negative effects on their psychologies. You look at a show like The Oprah Winfrey Show, you talk about a woman who was herself a victim of incest and rape, who got herself into a position to have a forum, and in that forum, she brought a lot of light and attention into these issues. So, you know, a movie like The Shining and a visionary like Kubrick, who is folding in as many quanta of reality as possible, I think it's very legitimate to take the perspective on this movie and to look at it exclusively through that lens. It's almost as just saying that Kubrick in his his overarching story and his monomyth, even this didn't escape his attention. He understood what the culture of the time was very literally.
Sure.
Okay, so I'm saying it doesn't have to handicap or be removed. It just needs to be looked at, and that's what the whole movie is about, right? It's about going to room 237, opening the door, and looking inside and seeing, and that's it's about perception.
Well, sure, but I mean, one of the things that, like, I would agree with what you're saying here, Bill, because at the height of magazine culture, let me put this another way. Maybe what Kubrick is saying here is that all forms of media are forms of pornography. And this is something that I've wondered about a lot, because, like, even things that don't appear to have any pornographic content can actually be pornographic and are pornographic in their nature. So that could be what's being said, and that could account for the blankness of the reaction and the fact that Jack would choose to read this magazine without any fear of being detected as a person with some unusual interests. I mean, and as I was saying about magazine culture, I mean, you know, I grew up in magazine culture, and when I was a kid, you could go to a doctor's office and you might find a Playboy magazine in among the magazines there. It happened. So, and you know, as people used to say, well, I read it for the articles, right? And this is this concept of the mixture of pornography with legitimate literary criticism and political thought. Actually, what it really does is it just puts it all together and makes it all porn. Essentially, it's all porn. Now.
Wait, but so the mixing of the sacred and the profane makes everything profane, or does it make everything sacred?
It does. Absolutely.
The potential? I just want to ask you: is there not the potential to make everything sacred?
I don't think so. I mean, to me, that's very easy to answer, right? The rape of children cannot be sacred. If that's what we consider as a sacred value, then I'd say that we already are admitting what I'm trying to express, that we live essentially in hell, right? And in hell, nothing can be sacred. It's the antipode, the antidote of everything that's sacred. And, you know, just in regards to the concept of what is sacred, maybe sacred isn't the right word. I actually prefer to use the word good. You know, if there was, to me, goodness is a kind of a weak force in the world. It doesn't have very much strength. It can exist. It's almost like it bubbles up in the surface of this cauldron in which we live and appears for a moment in time and then is consumed by the fire of its opposite, basically. And the strength and the power of this force appears, you know, I said this earlier, like in regards to, say, watching the news. When you mix lies in with the truth, when you put certain types of images next to each other in persistently and very skillfully intimate the connection between these things, you inevitably end up making it all negative, right? It's like anything short of complete goodness is not goodness, is I guess what I'm saying. So that to me is the kind of the secret of juxtaposing these kinds of images with each other.
Mark, so if a Playgirl magazine had an article or a review of Stanley Kubrick's The Shining in it, that magazine would still be profane. But if you had Stanley Kubrick's The Shining with a Playgirl magazine in it, could it still remain sacred?
Well, what's becoming sacred, the film or the magazine?
Well, I'm saying that Stanley Kubrick's vision is a vision of such intense clarity.
I see what you're getting at. No, I see where you're going here. And I guess because maybe balanced is the better word, not sacred. Like the idea of something sacred to me, I guess, and this could just be something that I struggle with, is the idea of something that would instantaneously have an almost utopian effect on reality, that if the true sacred value could actually be discovered, then the concept of human suffering would simply disappear completely and universally. So but within the structure where that where suffering exists, I do not find the sacred. However, what I might find and what I would say is that maybe a balanced version of reality is being presented by Kubrick. A truly
I think you have to separate pain from suffering, correct?
Not really, no.
Pain is something that if that's what floats your boat in an S&M sort of way, you wouldn't want that necessarily to go away. But then someone would say, but all S&M is just a reaction to the suffering that you were programmed with.
There's the idea that, you know, we talk about balance, the sort of homeostasis as the preferable state. But you mentioned earlier Dante's Inferno, and I don't necessarily 100% agree with Dante's philosophy here. This one particular aspect, he in Canto 12 of the Inferno, of course, line 42, we have a reference to this sort of order out of chaos as being a negative thing. The idea that you, he says here, I thought the universe was thrilled with love, whereby there are who deem the world hath oft been into chaos turned, and in that point, here and elsewhere, that old rock toppled down, which is a reference to the death of Christ. The notation here is, following the doctrine of the pre-Socratic philosopher Empedocles, Virgil believed the world was ruled by two principles, hatred and love. When the former prevails, the world exists and is well organized. This is, hatred is well organized. When the latter prevails, the elements are mixed together and chaos ensues. From a Christian perspective, the death of Jesus represents the highest expression of love, and therefore the reason for a dramatic return to primordial chaos.
Well, I would actually completely agree with that, and my only problem is with that it's not the text itself, but it's in the way in which what I'm returning here to is a common interpretation. Like, that is a very sophisticated understanding of the concept of love. As a matter of fact, it trends directly into Crowley and the concept of love is the law, essentially, and that law being the law of chaos itself. My problem is not in actually that description that you gave, Alan. I actually do agree with that. I think it's dead on the money. But my problem is that the common interpretation, and it's common to the point of where, you know, when people say love, they don't mean something that includes difficult or horribly difficult, sometimes tragic elements. That they, in their mind's eye, love is something that has a meaning that is universally positive. And that's what I'm trying to imply here, is that
I just want to challenge you for a moment, because your idea was that, you know, it can't be sacred if it has these profane elements. The profane takes over. So if you're saying the sophisticated idea of love is that it incorporates both pain and suffering into it, so then therefore the sacred is also contains the profane, this chaotic, unpleasant struggle is included within the quote unquote true definition of love. So is not the sacred including the profane, that it's not necessarily being overwhelmed by the profane, but that it...
Well, you know, like, I really can't disagree with you, because what you're really describing, and you know, how this all fits in with Crowley and the idea of love, particularly this concept of Nuit, or who is essentially Isis, right? And this is the point. I made this point in my article, my cycle of articles about The Shining, is that the material construct, which is the loving mother, it can't reject what is inherently problematic, right? It can't throw out the baby with the bathwater, so to speak. So it has to include, it has to allow into its womb everything that's evil, and then find a way to reconcile all of that underneath the concept of love. So I do agree with you completely. I agree with you completely that in a sense, love is this sacred principle that we're talking about, but my problem is not with that at all. It's with this common perception of love And my problem is that this perception of love is an advertised perception, right? The normal conception of love is something that alleviates suffering and pain and torment in one's world is not just a commonplace a perception, but it's a perception that is heavily advertised and repeated over and over works that appeal, in works of art that are meant to appeal to wide masses. And to me, that's a form of occult manipulation. So it's the sense of ambivalence, the ambiguousness of it, that I really want to get at here. And that, for me, that's always there when I'm talking about this, is that I can't quite feel good about it, you know? So I guess that's what I'm trying to get across.
Trust me, I have immense sympathy for that. Ultimately, we're struggling with the idea of what is the role of struggle? I have immense sympathy. If I just want to turn this over to John for a second, because I'm familiar with the sort of overarching philosophy of most of the people on the call, but John, I'm curious, you know, there's this idea of whether it's occult manipulation or the different symbolism that's being used, or what is the message that we're getting out of our media, if the media is the message. Do you have a sort of specific, or is there a sort of central philosophy that you're working with? I'm just curious.
No, not really.
That's cool. I mean, that's I'm just curious.
I mean, like you can come, like I'll go back to what Mark was talking about lies and truth being next to each other. And kind of refer to allusion Kubrick made in his interview with Michael Cimet about the Blue Hotel, the Stephen Crane's short story, in which a protagonist is a gambler, but also paranoid. So he thinks that everyone is trying to cheat on him. And so he has this paranoid breakdown in the middle of a card game and shoots somebody. But it turns out, even though he was insane and shot this guy for the wrong reason, the guy was still actually cheating. So this Kubrick had this idea that he worked with and was aware of and like put in all his movies that the truth is not an either or situation, but it's something more three dimensional.
Sure, yeah.
Of just, you know, piece like his chess metaphor, there are pieces on the board. Like there's black and white checkers, but the main thing is it's an architectural three dimensional space that pieces are being moved around in. And I guess maybe that could be closer to what my philosophy is that, you know, there are just things that exist and that produce their own truth, you know, as a kind of radiation.
Yeah. I had a conversation with someone the other day who was talking about the idea that, if, in my opinion, this sort of, you know, what he was referring to as moral relativism, you know, where the bad guy doesn't think he's a bad guy. He thinks, you know, he's doing it for the right reasons. And the good guy isn't just purely good, they're conflicted as well. And I was saying that I thought the best art, the best fiction is playing up this reality that there it's not just simply black and white, that there are all these, you know, sort of other layers. And this guy saw it as a manipulation by the media to promote moral relativism so that you couldn't easily define good or bad so that they can do their bad. And you know, this again presupposes that they think of themselves as bad and they're covering something. What if they think of themselves, you know, it's just, again, it's like,
Well, they don't have to, they don't have to think of themselves as bad for us to think of them as bad. I mean, we can see them, or when I say we, I mean, it is possible that they, whoever they are, could be perceived as bad without that they themselves thinking that they were bad at all. But, you know, actually, I hope, if you guys don't mind, I'd like to kind of dial this down a bit, because we've been talking for quite a while and we're probably going to wrap it up fairly soon. But I want to take it right back into the text of The Shining itself. I'm interested in what any of you guys think about the conversation that takes place between Stuart Ullman and Watson right after the interview when Jack is talking on the phone with Wendy. In the scene behind them, we can't hear what they're saying, but we can see a very, very tense and involved conversation taking place between Ullman and Watson. I'm wondering if you guys have any theories or ideas as to what that conversation might be about.
Well, it's, on one level, it's probably just about them like discussing Jack, the reality of Jack becoming the caretaker. You know, because usually, like, even you could even be hired for a job and still not have it. You know, like there's always a discussion of whether it's going to pan out. And and there's also that the things that they had to go, they still have a lot of things to go over. That's the big one. Another big mystery is what the heck did they do for like hours after this interview that Jack has to be home so late? Which could be, you know, an explanation of why they're not shocked when he's reading Playgirl magazine, because maybe they're sizing him up for some Eyes Wide Shut tomfoolery in the Gold Room. You know?
Well, yeah, I mean, I sort of get that feeling. I mean, I don't have a strong theory myself. That's partly why I was asking. And, you know, what you're saying, John, makes sense in the sense of a regular surface narrative. But the next time you guys are looking at this scene, the body language in the scene, to me, seems to be taking place between two lovers, essentially. Ullman is playing the penitent husband. It's like he's done something wrong. It's like his wife, played by Watson, has caught him at something. And the way in which he's standing with his arms crossed and kind of, he appears almost to be sniping at Stuart Ullman when they're talking to each other. And he also appears to be the dominant one as well. And I think all that's very interesting. And I was hoping that you guys would have something spectacular to tell me about it, but it's worth looking at. It's one of those mysteries that I don't feel has been greatly explored.
Now,
it goes back to the theme of the replacement, is that Jack is Watson's replacement. Watson is the caretaker, so Jack's going to take the place of Watson during the winter.
And if it's his lover, then certainly there's that other element of taking the place. It's Ullman's desk that has the red book on it, correct? So we must assume that he is at least aware of psychology, probably very aware of psychology if he's going to read something that advanced. So he probably summed this character up pretty quickly and we would assume, pretty well.
Yeah, okay. All right, actually, that makes a lot of sense. The idea that the Jack will be replacing Watson is interesting, but yeah, okay, I'll have to leave that for now, but I thought I'd open that up before we start to wind down too much. Not that I'm ready to quit. I'm still enjoying myself a great deal.
I like Bill's comment here about Red Book Magazine. He said Red Book Magazine would be very different.
Don't forget Halloran's watchword that assholes sometimes need to be replaced. You know, that in anal sex, eventually you might wear something out and need a new one.
Well, even on that chair that Jack types in the crown or the crest of the chair, it's clearly what looks to me as the engraving of an asshole.
Oh, yeah.
It's the black sun. It's the alchemical black sun at the top of the pyramid, which is why the assholes are in charge. And so, of course, Halloran is saying that, you know, he has to go through this whole Alex Gillard thing and poke out the top of the pyramid, as seen on the Fuck with Orange poster.
This idea, the idea of the asshole, actually plays into to the whole Saturn versus Uranus thing as well.
Said about Nuet, you said about Nuet. I mean, Nuet is the goddess of the sky. Is basically Uranus is the same thing. It's the spirit of the sky, and it's he has. We know that his child Kronos actually cuts his genitals off. It's the same thing when Danny picks up that knife and that lipstick. When you said the choice that he seems to be making is maybe to castrate his father.
Yeah, I believe it's actually a revenge act that he's taking place. He's at what he's
Hold
not.
On, it's Barry Lyndon.
Hey, Mark.
Repetition of the movie Barry Lyndon, where the son kills the father.
Hey, Mark, take a seat because you're about to fall down. But your Uranus is in the right, in the upper right hand corner of the Tree of Life there. So. The north right eye.
The brown eye. Now, what about when he says?
Hey, guys, I got a split. Hate to dash out like this, but I have a pressing appointment and gotta go.
Hey, thanks for joining us, John.
Thank you very much.
Great chatting with you, John.
Yeah, you bet. See you later.
So if he calls Wendy dear, you know, this sort of my dear wife, Wendy darling, what is Sherlock's thing? You know, it's elementary, my dear Watson. So you have both the, but going back to elements, you have my dear Watson or Wendy darling. Right, it's elemental. And then there's the old saying, no shit, Sherlock, you know, presumably that Watson's saying. So here we have John's idea of Wendy being constipated. If she's my dear Watson, no shit, Sherlock, perhaps she's constipated.
Well, this fits into the idea that I was talking about before. If Wendy is representative of like a world mother, essentially, she can't reject anything. And this is the whole, to me, this is the complete mystery of The Shining. Like, Jack, or not, Wendy loves Jack and she loves Danny. She loves them both, and she's trying to find a way to accept them both, essentially. So that's her constipation right there, is that there's these two elements which she has to accept into her material self. Into her physical body, that she is she's trying to reconcile, basically.
You know, when you guys were talking about TV, there's that scene, you know, where he comes through the door and he says, "Here's Johnny." You know, he learned that from the TV. Just kind of throw that out there. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's all there.
He's breaking.
Yeah, they see the mystery on the television before they then enact it, and they come to the scene of the Overlook and go through this pre-recorded myth that they've already seen so many times in fiction.
Right. By quoting the TV as he's breaking down the door, it's essentially breaking down the fourth wall, no?
Right.
Sure.
He's breaking the egg.
Right.
He's becoming the host. You know, it's a pity that John, or Jason, yeah, John, John had to take off because he's introducing himself, right? And the way in which his face is framed, the way in which his face is framed, it's like he's peeking out from behind curtains, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's chopped open a section of the door, so it's almost like he's opening up curtains and pushing his face through and going, "Here's Johnny," right? He's entering on the stage as the new host of the show, right? And that's what he's doing. And, you know, in the final picture of him at the end of the film, that's what he is. He's the host. He's become, he's been elevated from level of caretaker to the level of the host itself, essentially.
Right.
And this fits in to my idea that the Shining is essentially a film about the revenge of Uranus on Saturn, right? It's Danny represents, well, he's Apollo, and he's avenging his grandfather's murder at the hands of his father, Saturn, essentially. So he what he does is he forces, are you guys losing me, or we're still good? He forces Jack to eat himself, essentially. He's forcing Jack to consume himself.
How so?
He forces him, because Halloran represents Jack's penis, right? Like in the kitchen, you know, Halloran says, "Hey, what do you think? Is it big enough for you?" And essentially, that's what's happening is, you know, Halloran is Dick. Halloran is Jack.
Right.
Why did he say he's Jack's dick?
Well,
I'm just
because
curious.
I feel. All right. Well. All right. This is a theory based upon the idea I have that when, like, for instance, when Halloran has his first discussion with Danny in the kitchen, we are given the impression that it's Halloran who's doing the reading and not the other way around. But I think that, in fact, Danny is the one doing the reading. Danny's reading Halloran, basically. And all of the cues of what Danny is reading are presented in the conversation when they're walking around the kitchen, when Halloran is showing them around the kitchen. There are probably 8 or 10 verbal cues. You know, do you like lamb doc? Is it big enough for you? Things like this that indicate that exactly, yes. That's right. How would you like some ice cream, Doc? How would you like my eyes cream? You remember eyes back in the day, right? In the days of early African, when the Africans were still mostly slaves, they didn't say me. They said eyes, right? So they'd say, oh, eyes do, they would say eyes doing this, or, you know, they always use the word eyes, the plural of I, as me. And so when Halloran says, how would you like some eyes cream, Doc? And he actually says that. How would you like some eyes cream, Doc? It's a drawl. He's imitating the drawl of slaves. And what he's saying, how would you like some of my cream, basically. So it's really Danny who's doing all of the shining in this. And he realizes right away that Halloran is a part of this structure. And that structure is represented by the symbol of Saturn, which is then something that a spirit that invades Jack. This actually happens in the scene where he's, you know, looking up he's got his sweater, his turtleneck sweater on, and he's staring up. And this is at the moment when the complete connection between Saturn and Jack is made. So what Danny is doing is he sees Dick Halloran as the penis of the Overlook. And because, you know, Jack...
The turtleneck sweater, right? Like the turtle head is basically the head that goes in and out of the shell, or Shelley Duvall. But even, you know, as a sort of penis, as the sort of turtle head that goes in and out, I think that's interesting if you're saying that's when he's getting... you know, taking on this spirit, he'd be wearing the turtleneck sweater, I think is actually pretty funny.
Yeah. And what's happening here is that, like, Jack inhabits the Overlook, and the Overlook inhabits Jack. It's a destined meeting, because Jack has come to represent, over the course of his short, unsuccessful life, these Saturnine principles, basically. So he's a perfect fit to go in here and become the host, essentially. And, you know, the term host is the exact term that's used for the Eucharist, right? When you take the body of Christ, they call it the host. The little cracker they give you is called the host. And, of course, the host is the guy that puts on the party, right? He's the guy that feeds everybody. So what Danny is doing is avenging Uranus, basically. He's saying, you know, you cut off your father's penis, killing him, and molded reality out of that blood, and you've been consuming that blood, but I'm going to turn that back on you now, and I'm going to make you consume yourself within the Overlooks, get you stuck into that place so that your perambulations become minimized, essentially.
Making him become the Ouroboros, the cycle of time.
That's right, he's eating himself. He's essentially hosting himself. He becomes his own host. And it's a way of getting back at the fact that he cannibalized his father.
It's kind of like the green lion eating the sun.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Does anybody know what day Stanley Kubrick was born on? Because I think he's a Leo.
No, I don't.
I'm going to check that out right now.
Yeah.
Curious about that.
Well, I think it's interesting that
no.
2001 is.
Oh yeah, he's a Leo.
2001 is.
He's a Leo.
Bear this in mind.
Kubrick is a Leo.
2001 in Space Odyssey came out the exact same day that Martin Luther King was killed. So you have the King kill and 2001 a Space Odyssey. Eyes Wide Shut came out the exact same day that JFK Jr. was killed.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Definitely. So essentially, Kubrick is identifying himself, you know, as the Wizard of Oz or the Green Lion in this case. And he it does turn out that he is a Leo. I just checked on Wikipedia. His birthday is July 26th. So,
it's the day before the Olympics open, by the way, this year.
Oh, very interesting. Very interesting. But what I was going to add was that so you have this thing where you have the lion eating the sun. The lion representing Saturn is consuming Apollo, who is the sun, or Christ through the Eucharist, right? And then within the context of the film The Shining, you have an attempt by Apollo to take revenge on Saturn for it. And I think the ultimate message of The Shining is that Apollo, or Danny, it fails, essentially, in his revenge. Because as he drives up the hill, the final shot of him in the snowcat with Wendy, there's a cross. There's a Christian cross sitting next to him. So he's basically, he can't escape the cycle, essentially. So even though he is able to throw back some of the cannibalistic aspects of Saturn's behavior right back at Saturn, he's still stuck in the loop.
Right, and that's the same with all of the endings of Kubrick's films, where on one hand, it's like they're trapped between these two worlds, where on one hand, there's Danny who escapes from the House of Doom, but on the other side, he's trapped there forever inside of the monolith, by which, by whatever name you want to call it.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff, guys.
Now, you know.
So what do you think?
Oh, wait, I just want to throw out the, it's the Norse goddess Freyja.
Freya.
I guess you'd say. She has a chariot that's led by two cats, which of course, you know, we see the tarot card. The chariot is being pulled by two cats, the two sphinxes. But her chariot is the two cats, and Wendy is trying to get to the snow cat is her chariot, and we see her drive off in that. Do you see any mythological correlation there?
Well, sure, because there's also two cats, right?
Exactly, yeah, as I'm saying.
There's the one that gets sabotaged, and then the one that they inevitably go away in. Yeah, that's very interesting. Mm. What are the attributes of Freya? What does she represent in Norse mythology?
I'm not great on Norse mythology. Anybody? That's why I'm asking. Actually,
she's definitely an Isis figure.
Yeah, well, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And of course, Norris is Norse, right?
Sure. Yeah. All right. I think we're breaking down to the level of absurdity here.
I think. Like, I feel like there's definitely something to this. I wish I knew more about her mythology.
She has a chariot that pulled by cats. I mean, that's pretty absurd.
All right. Well, like I said, I'm probably going to dig into that. I see here, I'm just looking on Wikipedia, there's a correlation between her as fertility goddess connected to rye. So, of course, we see Wendy reading Catcher in the Rye.
And, of course, Jack drinks rye. He drinks, whiskey, anyway.
Yeah.
Jack Daniels, yeah.
Ah, yeah, very interesting. Throughout the Shining, we see, like, Wednesday... I remember, like, there's a sort of play up on Wednesday. Now, Wednesday is Odin's day. Do we see a Friday, which would be her day, or do we see a correlation anywhere there?
That's an interesting question. There must be something there. I'm not sure if there's actually a title card for Friday. I'm pretty sure there's not. But very funny. But I think actually. There are some resources. John would probably know this off the top of his head because he looks at those title cards and he's very aware of the datings in The Shining, like exactly when on the calendar things are happening in the movie. It's actually quite clear. Oh, I'm a robot. Cut me out.
Yeah, it's a shame we don't have John with us to give that quick answer. but I think it's something worth looking into, because they do play up. I mean, I feel like the fact that they put that title card, you know, it's essentially the same thing as saying, you know, Jupiter and Beyond the Infinite. You know, it's like, here's a title card saying, like, now this. So seeing, if we see a title card that says Jupiter and we see a title card that says Moon, it's like seeing a title card that says Moon Day and seeing a title card that says Wednesday or Odin's Day is basically telling you, now we're at this part of the myth.
Right.
I agree completely.
By the way, if you guys are interested, if you have a copy of Catcher in the Rye, during the opening sequence with Danny, the first time we were introduced to Danny and Wendy, she's reading Catcher in the Rye sitting there at the lunch table, and the page that she's reading is page 133. So if you want to read it and just see, maybe you know, something for a later discussion, or I've looked at it myself. I had to figure out. It wasn't that hard to find out what page it was, but I'm 100% correct, or 100% sure that it's page 133 of the standard paperback version of Catcher in the Rye. So you should check it out. There's something about monkeys in there, believe it or not.
Well, if there's something about monkeys in there, and that's in our initial scene of Danny, you can obviously tie that to the dawn of man. And then if we get to Halloran with the vinyl record that has Peter Sellers in it, are we all the way up to Dr. Strangelove at that point?
Well, in a sense, that's what I imply, you know. Go ahead, Jason.
Where's Peter Sellers?
There's the record that we were talking about that is next to Halloran's television in his bedroom in Miami. And it's called Commoner's Crown, and it's by a band called Steel Eye Spain. The cover, which we talked about, is a crown that's comprised of little human figurines. But the other absurd novelty of it is that Peter Sellers plays ukulele on a song called New York Girls on that album.
Okay, that is crazy. So it's Peter Sellers' ghost again. He's always kind of haunting the background.
So, yeah, so Stanley is putting Sellers once again into one of his movies, albeit in a very, very fractal way. But does this speak somewhat to where we are in the monomyth with Peter Sellers showing up along with television and along with the progression of The Shining? If we're seeing monkeys in The Catcher in the Rye,
I pulled the book down off my shelf. It's actually chimpanzees. So it's actually really interesting. There's also, it says here, you give me, come on, let's get out of here, I said. You give me a royal pain in the ass if you want to know the truth. A royal pain in the ass.
Beautiful.
He says, but there's also hotels. So he says, she says, we'll have oodles of time to do those things, all those things. I mean, after you go to college and all, if we should get married and all, there'd be oodles of marvelous places to go. No, there wouldn't. There wouldn't be oodles of places to go at all. It would be entirely different. I said, I was getting depressed as hell again. Blah, blah, blah. I said, no, there wouldn't be marvelous places to go after I went to college and all. Open your ears. It'd be entirely different. We'd have to go downstairs in elevators with suitcases and stuff. We'd have to phone up everybody and tell them goodbye and send them postcards from hotels and all. And I'd be working in some office, making a lot of dough and riding to work in cabs and Madison Avenue buses and reading newspapers and playing bridge all the time and going to the movies and seeing a lot of stupid shorts and coming attractions and newsreels. Newsreels, Christ almighty. There's always a dumb horse race and some dame breaking a bottle over a ship. Interesting. And some chimpanzee riding a goddamn bicycle with pants on. It wouldn't be the same at all.
Bicycle, right?
Yeah,
Daisy, right?
Exactly. Some chimpanzee riding a goddamn bicycle with pants on. Wouldn't be the same at all. I was sorry I'd started it. Come on, let's get out of here. Give me a royal pain in the ass if you want to know the truth. Damn. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty damned interesting.
That guy is good, man.
Yeah.